Radio Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in today for Anthony Brooks.
A major verdict in a potentially precedent-setting federal terrorism case today. A jury found Tariq Mahana, an American-born man from Sudbury, guilty on all counts, including conspiring to provide material support to Al-Qaeda, lying to FBI agents, and conspiring to kill in a foreign country.
Federal prosecutors said that Mahana traveled to Yemen in 2004 to seek terrorism training. He never got that training and instead turned to translating Al-Qaeda texts, which he posted on the internet.
Reaction from law enforcement, lawyers, and Mahana's own family was swift and emotional. Here's Omar Abdelkader, a friend of Mahana, just after the jury announced its verdict.
I feel like this is all just a bigger part of promoting Islamophobia in this country, and it's just like, it's ridiculous. I can't feel safe being an American Muslim anymore.
WBUR senior reporter David Boeri was at the courthouse today and joins us now. Hi, David.
Hi, Adam.
So this verdict came very fast. Was it a surprise?
It certainly came fast, and yes, to observers of the court, it came as a big surprise. They filed in this morning. They could not have deliberated any more than 10 hours, could not have done that. And they came in this morning after just an hour's deliberation. They came in with their verdicts, heads down, every one of them. And Adam, this is a single rule I've always observed. Not one looking at the defendant. It was pretty clear he was done.
The Mahana family has been very present at the trial. What was their reaction?
I thought that at first it seemed fatalistic and then stoic, and then Mahana's mother broke down. She was sobbing in grief, fell to the floor several times inside the courtroom and then outside. The family was left weeping. I think they were stunned.
And what did Mahana's defense team have to say?
Their reaction was striking, and in fact, Janice Basil, a real veteran of the courts, was crying at the verdict. Outside, they expressed bitterness at what happened. Here's defense attorney J.W. Carney.
One of the most important would be the extraordinary leeway that the prosecution was given to put inflammatory, prejudicial evidence day after day, week after week, that was really so important to the charges that that evidence was never once mentioned during either prosecutor's closing argument. And what an appellate court will have to decide is whether the real motivation for putting that evidence before the jury was to scare them and prejudice them.
Now, what J.W. Carney is talking about there is one of the reasons for an appeal. And they are very bitter at what was allowed in the court here by the judge, George O'Toole. This was a case largely, Adam, this was a case of Osama bin Laden being on trial and Al-Qaeda being on trial. And yet the most culpable person in the room was none other than Tariq Mahana. At one point during the cross-examination of a government witness by J.W. Carney, Carney stopped and sarcastically said, "I tell you what, let me let you say Osama bin Laden one more time. Why don't you say that one more time?" They showed pictures of 9/11. They showed a picture of Mahana with friends seemingly celebrating their being at 9/11. There was pictures, videotapes of suicide bombers and of torture. There was all sorts of things that the government continued to put in front of those jurors. And the defense says this was clearly inflammatory.
So what is the prosecution's take on the verdict? They see it as a win in the war on terror?
This is a vital win, they say. And in fact, Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, made the point that they used against Mahana, they used his own statements, they used tape recordings of him, instant messages, his translations, that they caught him in his own words. Here she is outside.
The job of law enforcement agencies and prosecutors is to bring terrorists to justice, and it is vitally important that we prevent incidents of terrorism before they happen.
So she is saying they stopped him, they stopped it before because of their work. And she discounted the idea of inflammatory evidence inserted by the government, saying, in fact, again, as I had mentioned earlier, these were words translated by Mahana, and also was the testimony of his friends. It's important to remember here, his friends were all offered deals in the course of this thing. They were offered immunity, and his co-defendant is outside the country. He is considered a fugitive. So let's go to Alok Chakravarti, the U.S. attorney, after the hearing and talking about what the government plans to do to follow up.
We'll continue to investigate any other individual, whether they were a witness in this case or otherwise, who has violated the laws in this state.
Mr. Abu Samra, at this point, to your knowledge?
I think the testimony at trial, which is the only thing I'll comment on, is that he went to Syria.
Why was he allowed to leave if you know everything about him at this time?
We'll quibble with your characterization that he was allowed to leave.
Yeah.
If you read the indictment, there was no criminal charge preventing him from leaving the United States. He's a United States citizen. He was allowed to go.
But this is important, that Abu Samra, the co-defendant in this case, was allowed to leave the country even though the FBI had interviewed him at the time. Now, they say they were upholding his rights. It's a little hard to believe they couldn't find a reason for keeping him in the country. They allowed him to go. Mm-hmm. The defense is saying everybody beside Mahana, but Mahana, got some sort of deal in order to get Mahana. And they're very bitter about this, and they think this is going to go to the appeals court.
WBUR's David Bureri, you'll have more reporting for us later today in All Things Considered. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, when it comes to the boundaries between constitutionally protected civil liberties and the government's power to pursue terrorists, the Mahana guilty verdict thrusts the country into new territory. One key issue? At what point does what you say align so closely with what you do or intend to do that it becomes a security threat? Here's U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz just moments after the verdict was handed down.
Once the government learned that Mr. Mahana's, of his intentions towards America, especially American soldiers, and his increasing radicalization, to have done nothing would have been inexcusable.
Defense Attorney J.W. Carney, however, felt very differently.
This case can't help but send a message to people that if you support an unpopular cause, you better be looking over your shoulder, because the federal government may be right behind you.
Joining us now is Harvey Silverglate. He's a Boston criminal defense attorney and civil liberties litigator and author of Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Harvey Silverglate.
Well, it's good to be back, although not under great circumstances.
Also with us on the line is Captain Glenn Solmazy. He's a law professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut and author of The National Security Court System, A Natural Evolution of Justice in an Age of Terror. Captain Solmazy, welcome back to you as well.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, let me first start with you, Captain Solmazy. How far does the Mahana verdict expand the government's ability to go after alleged terrorists based on what they say?
I actually don't think it does. I think I would take issue with that. It actually is an example and a great victory of how we're going to combat and how the Obama administration will combat terrorism and homegrown terrorism in the 21st century. I really think they struck a balance, and you can see by the verdict by the jury, coming back within under 10 hours, guilty on four counts, a variety of things, not just about any issues that have come from a civil liberties perspective, but lying to federal agents, about trying to, a conspiracy to kill in a foreign country. These are charges that are fairly clear, fairly straightforward, and I think the jury unanimously saw this as being that, unfortunately, Mr. Mahana was guilty and should be sentenced here in April.
So as you said, there are seven counts, and he was found guilty on all of them, but it's that, I suppose, that the conspiracy to provide material support count, which this civil liberties and First Amendment question is all bound up in. Harvey Silverglate, your response.
Well, the material support statute is one of the most dangerous statutes for civil liberties that have been enacted since I've been practicing law for almost 45 years. The definition is extraordinarily vague. Nobody can define it. But if what Mahana did is a crime, material support, there are a lot of criminals walking around in this country. And I think we could depend on the government to begin going after them one at a time. And soon, of course, they'll get to people like us.
Now, specifically, what Mahana did is that he translated Al-Qaeda texts into English, particularly one notoriously called 39 Ways, I believe, to Practice Jihad. That's a paraphrase of the title. And then he translated that into English and puts it on the Internet.
Correct.
Now, Captain Glenn Solmazy, let me ask you, it seems like what is at the heart of this matter, one of the things is that there was a recent Supreme Court opinion that found that you can belong to a terrorist organization, you can advocate for the goals of a terrorist organization, but you can't work for them or be, quote, in coordination with them. And it's this in coordination question, which specifically U.S. District Judge George O'Toole said when he was giving the jury its its instructions. He said, independent advocacy on behalf of an organization is not a violation of the law. So has this guilty verdict sort of lowered the bar in terms of what independent advocacy or protected advocacy is?
No, I think they actually, this case shows clearly that it wasn't just simple advocacy, and that clearly is protected by the First Amendment, as Harvey and I would agree, and I think your listeners would agree, something that if he and I say that we disagree with the administration, we should be protected by the First Amendment. That's distinct from actually taking, translating text and attempting in efforts to convert others to wage jihad against U.S. interests and to kill U.S. soldiers. That's significantly different, and there clearly was enough, the prosecution, and I do applaud U.S. Attorney Ortiz for her efforts and her team's efforts to convince the jury that it was clearly more than just that. It was more than just a protected right or an advocacy on behalf of a cause. It was actually advocacy to create a cause or to change something or to conduct a certain action that would be against the interests of the U.S. government. And for that, I think she should be applauded.
Harvey Silverglate, do you buy that? I mean, this idea that just translating something and attempting to change or influence action should no longer be so stringently protected.
Let me give you an objective answer to your question. In February of 2003, a Saudi grad student named Omar al-Hussein was acquitted by a jury for doing precisely that by a jury in Boise, Idaho, federal jury in Boise, Idaho. What I think the verdict here tells us is how far the country has gone down the anti-liberty road between February 2003 and December 2011.
But Harvey, let me ask you, though. I mean, the government seems to, in repeated conversations or press conferences it's been given, prosecutors have gone out of their way of saying it's not just the translations. It's the pattern of behavior and activity along with the translation that, in total, leads to this charge of material support. I mean, so if there were no pattern around him making a translation, maybe this wouldn't even be an issue.
Well, there was certainly a pattern. The question is, was anything in this pattern a crime or indicative of a real terrorist? And I think that if you take a step back, the answer is no. But, you know, juries are very nervous about protecting the homeland. It's the reason why these prosecutions are so dangerous. All we have to rely on now is that the appellate courts can be somewhat more objective. And, you know, they have been up until now, but who knows?
Glenn Slomazy, your response to that?
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. I think the key is what you said, is that we can't look at this in isolation. We have to look at the broad and the totality of the circumstances which have taken place. And I respectfully disagree with my friend Harvey. He traveled to Yemen in 2004 to seek terrorism training. He planned to attack in Iraq and fight U.S. troops, to join in the fight against U.S. troops in Iraq. Those are just two examples where you can't simply say he was just advocating his political discourse. He was clearly engaged in jihad against the United States. And it's clearly, this is a case where it could have been different, but I think it was so clear, the evidence to the jury, that within 10 hours they came back with a conviction. And again, I do think we have to look at this as also, this is a great thing about America. They can appeal this case. If there was a flaw, if there was something found incorrect in our system, in our jury finding, in our procedures, then we can appeal this case. What a great country we live in, that we're allowed to be able to do this and carry out appeals, where even in somebody like this that might have been actively pursuing against the interests of the United States, that we do have the criminal process in place. We have a conviction. We'll have the sentencing in April, but they can appeal, and I'm sure the appeal will be upheld. But I think that they have that opportunity to do that is quite tremendous.
I mean, I know that, so based on the jury's all guilty verdict, they definitely felt that it was clear. But I wonder, how clear is it? Because we keep running around this word intent. I mean, it's difficult to, have we reached a point where intent is enough to be, you know, in violation of U.S. law?
I don't think so. I think certainly we know in criminal law, in basic criminal law, we have something called mens rea, which is the criminal intent is part of what has to be for a crime to have been committed. So some of that you're seeing here is being, if we look at this in a broad scope, if we look in isolation, any one of the charges, we would say, okay, maybe not. I think in the totality of all of the charges and looking at each step that he's done in the pattern that was laid out by the prosecution successfully, it leads one to believe that he was clearly not someone that was just going over to study in Yemen or to study under a certain mosque, or was clearly going over to engage in terrorist training, attempting to engage in jihad. His own words in his IMs and his email messages, all the evidence that was put forth was him saying it, that he wanted to engage in, encouraging others to join him, and how they would engage in jihad against U.S. citizens here. So I think sometimes when we're talking about these issues, it's quick and it's easy for us to forget. 10 years ago, we lost 3,000 people. What about the victims of those people? What about the victims of the troops fighting over in Afghanistan and Iraq, our U.S. citizens that have been victims? We have to kind of balance both sides, the rights of the individual in terms of him being tried, but also the rights of the victims. And it's easy to lose that sometimes 10 years later.
Harvey, go ahead.
There were no victims of what Mahana did. There were victims of the 9/11 attacks. But if you really think that this is that he planned to attack U.S. troops, that really has expanded the notion of conspiracy or planning to attack.
That was what the prosecutors put forth inside of the
That's how they characterize it, but that's an incredible stretch.
Harvey Silverglade, this case is certainly going to go to appeal, and so far I understand that appellate courts actually haven't had that many opportunities to weigh in on these very sort of the delicate balance here between civil liberties and these particular issues around the First Amendment and the conspiracy to provide material support question. But let me ask you, it'll be some time before an appellate court hears this case. What do you think the precedent is that the Mahana verdict sets? What kind of prosecutions do you think we could be seeing in the future?
Well, it moves the line very far over to the prosecution side. And I think that Americans, until this issue is resolved, as to where the line is drawn between actually providing material support and conspiring to attack troops and so forth, until that is more clearly delineated, I think there is going to be a cold effect on speech. People are going to watch what they say more so than any American has had to since at least the McCarthy period.
Captain Glenn Slomazy, last question to you. There is a line of thinking out there, and I've seen a lot of activity around it just today after the verdict was handed down.
Yes.
That says that if prosecutors win this case, which they did here in Boston Federal Court, it basically equates Mahana to being an enemy combatant, a U.S. citizen who lived most of his life on U.S. soil. And we've seen in the past, enemy combatants have been held in indefinite detention. They've been renditioned to foreign countries. They've been tried in military courts. There's even legislation right now in Washington that may legalize indefinite detention of U.S. citizens. So, I'm asking you to hypothesize here, but are we taking a step closer to labeling U.S. citizens as enemy combatants?
No, I do fear that, and I think in this case is not a case that we should look at for that sort of hyperbole. I don't think we're going there, but I do think that legislation, which I think you know I have it up in the San Francisco Chronicle detailing this, a concern that some of the legislation that's being put forth would actually tip the balance so far to the pro-government side away from not even civil liberties, but I think beyond that to human rights concerns about keeping people jailed indefinitely without trial, charge, or even a hearing of any sort, indefinitely. Well, that's the fear, and I think that's something, this case, if I could, I think we have to look at, it's that inflammatory language. I think that'll be the interesting thing on appeal for us to watch. What Defense Attorney Carney is saying that he is going to raise on appeal is the use of inflammatory language has somehow tainted the jury from making its decision. That'll be interesting to watch if they think that's more of a tactic than necessarily any change in the law.
Harvey Silverglade, last word briefly goes to you.
I think that Glenn is absolutely right that legislation shows that congressmen have been stampeded in panic, but now you can understand why it happened to a jury if the Congress can be bamboozled and panicked like this.
Harvey Silverglade is a Boston criminal defense attorney and civil liberties litigator and author of 3 Felonies a Day. Thanks so much again, Harvey.
Righto, thank you.
Also, Captain Glenn Slomazy, law professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut and author of The National Security Court System. Thank you so much as well.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Up next on the show, a BU study of Boston area teens finds a surprising number of young girls engaging in sex with multiple partners at the same time. And they're often coerced into it. That's up next. I'm Adam Ragusea.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.